Welcome back to the Injury Pros Podcast. Today, we're diving into one of the most important and misunderstood tools available to injured plaintiffs, legal funding. Joining me is Andy Goetz, Vice President of Business Development at Thrivus Link Legal Funding. Thrivus Link is a company dedicated to helping injured people stay financially stable while their case moves forward. They provide personalized pre-settlement funding, helping plaintiffs cover essentials like rent, medical costs, and lost income without the pressure of repayment unless we win. Andy has spent years working directly with law firms and clients, and I'm excited to have him on today. I'm back from my reprieve as well. My hairline is back to full strength. So without any further ado, let's jump into this. So legal funding, as when I first met you, Andy, I was kind of apprehensive about the situation. I said, this doesn't sound right. Sounds fishy, as most people do. But looking at the facts, cracking some numbers, 63% live paycheck to paycheck. And 58% can't cover a $1,000 emergency. With that, and in my field, personal injury, 20 to 45 days off work after a major catastrophic crash, that's about $5,000 out-of-pocket medicals. How do you size advances responsibly? How fast can funds be delivered? Because if I'm injured, my panic in my mind is going to that. I need to pay for bills. I need to pay for schooling, for my son, for my daughter. Just day-to-day things that we don't think about until chaos and a motor vehicle crash or another injury occurs.
So like any good plaintiff attorney, I feel like we catch clients sometimes at their worst. They're in that spot of not knowing, not only with bills and making ends meet, but also trying to treat and feel better from something that occurred to them at no fault of their own. So I think being transparent and mitigating some of the pitfalls of funding is critical right when you meet someone from the get. And a lot of times, good attorneys can help help steer and advise their clients accordingly, so to avoid some of those pitfalls that are going to be upcoming.
So cutting right through the BS per se, how quickly can an individual who is in need of money, hired by our law firm, Cardisco and Sale, or whomever they are, how quickly can you get that to them if they needed it?
Right. So a lot of the things that we do are same day, next day. So our idea is let's get to the client. Let's be, again, transparent with them as to what they're doing. Let's talk about the interest rate, which I know we'll get into here in a little bit, and alleviate any stresses that they have that they can't take care of their family or their immediate needs.
So many times, and I've learned this as we've continued to work together over the years, with funding, that you guys serve an interesting purpose, not just to make sure that bills are paid and stability is enabled and continued. You guys actually help our settlements, which is kind of crazy if you think about it. So fast settlements have always been a thing. There's those lawyer mills out there, and we're not one of them. But what happens is you get into a crash, an insurance company's calling you, they're getting you on the phone, they're saying, we'll give you $500, we'll give you $1,000. This person is not even 24 hours off of an injury. And fast settlements are readily available, 50%, 70% below value. If a case should be settling for 100, they're getting 1,000 when they get to them that quickly. Do you fund just enough to prevent pressure settlements, or are you doing enough to ultimately allow them to understand the gravity of their injury? Because many times when people think of funding, they're thinking of a Band-Aid, a quick fix. The boat or canoe has a hole in it. And it's like that cartoon where they're putting one hole and plugging another, and another one pops up, another one pops up. How do you guys kind of see yourself in this of facilitating longevity and stability?
So my response to that would be, you know, funding isn't the end-all be-all right solution for every case, for every client. But some of the ways that we manage that is, and I know that, you know, so I'm with Thrivus Link, and I feel that we're one of the top funders in the space. And what we're trying to do is help the client not hurt the case, not put the attorney in a position where they succumb to a case being overfunded. So our metrics that we use is one that really works well is called a rolling contract. So let's say we have a client who is injured, is a fair wage earner, and needs some guidance on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis. We have a rolling contract that can sometimes defer some of the interest until the money is deployed to the client. The client knows that every month on the 5th, they're getting what they need, but it's not getting in the way of their continued treatment or in the way of the case resolving at the end, which could be 18 to 24 months down the road. You know, who knows? It can be a big a big gap that we fill.
And I think that's a good segue in a sense of, because I know at the end of the day, what is happening to, in our cases, when there's funding that is applicable and funding that's needed, not all cases need funding, it's case by case, but we're seeing at the end of the day that a small advance buys times for us and allows us to facilitate. It's that triangle that I always talk about. We are able to find available insurance. We're able to get the diagnosis and get the prognosis and understand the least complete picture in gravity. Like I mentioned earlier, the insurance company just wants you in and out because they don't want to pay all that money towards the future care. And this is a very nice facilitator to allow us to do that in this space. And it gives us time. And many of the times, we're not the ones that are dealing with the clients directly. I know that your team, and you can talk a little bit about that and what your team entails, but I'm giving you the information after the client expresses to me that they are in need of help. And that help can say, hey, Steve, I have rent, or I'm not working, or I need money to get me to the next month or to get me back. Like I have a client right now who is a DJ and he can't work because his lower back and his neck are killing him after a very serious crash where he was rear-ended by a tractor trailer and that car is in pieces. Thankfully, he's still with us. But his concern is, I need just to get better. I'm not 100% better, but I need that little bit of bridge to get me back to work so I can start facilitating that. And all I had to do was just contact you, talk with you about it, and your team jumps on it. It's not another thing for me to worry about. It's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So talk to me a little bit about how your company is really structured in a sense of receiving that and taking care of it. Because I know I send you the information, and before I know it, I'm getting a contract that I'm reviewing, and we'll jump into the contract a little bit later about what that entails and what the legality of all that stuff is. And then you just take it and run.
I'll use the word burden. Thrivus doesn't want to be a burden to the client, the individuals who's going through this horrible situation. We also don't want to be a burden to the attorney, the law firm, their staff. So what we try to do is for most intake, we try to get the pertinence, get the important information from the client, be the liaison, because we are the ones that control the control the money. You know, an attorney can come to us and say, you know, get John Smith $2,000. But that doesn't mean that we're going to advance $2,000. We want to look at some of the facts because we're not you. We're not the lawyers, you know, so we want to make sure that we check certain boxes and make sure the client knows that the decision is coming from the funder, not from the attorney. But the attorney is an enormous catalyst to getting the client that the help they need. Excuse me.
And I know that you've mentioned me before that you have the individuals looking at these cases are very law situated. Some are previous attorneys, some are familiar with that field, prior adjusters, and whatever that may be, they have the expertise. It's not just some layperson or Joe Schmo looking at it and saying, oh, they're asking for $2,500. It's a catastrophic injury. We'll give it to them and see where that kind of falls. These are experienced individuals that know what they're doing. And I think that that's what's one of the important parts about Thrivus and legal funding generally, is you got to kind of know who you're getting in bed with. And there's a lot of do's and don'ts out there, but talk to me a little bit about what makes a funder legit. I know that everybody can always say, hey, I got a friend. And we have it all the time in the attorney field, the dabblers, I call them. And what they do is they try to wear many hats and it blows up in their face. But what separates Thrivus, generally speaking, for legal funding? And this isn't a sales pitch or anything, but just why you guys? Like, what makes you guys the creme de la creme?
So I'm going to use an analogy that I think is really horrible, but I think it encapsulates what the question you just asked. As an attorney, as a plaintiff, I'd want to dance with the devil that I know and not the devil that I don't. And what I mean by that is these are relationships. You know, we know that we're getting the client the help that they need, but also we need to make sure that the case resolves at the end where we're not getting in the way. Through relationships, you have the ability to talk through the numbers at the end. You know, does your lien and what it's accrued to, which again, we'll go into in a minute, what it's accrued to makes sense for what we're owed back and what the case has netted and resulted in at the end. So
talk to me a little bit about that in regards to, so I know when I was on the outside looking in before I kind of got into the nitty gritty and the contract work, my biggest concern as a personal injury attorney, but also for my client, more priority and in regards to the hierarchy of concern, it was always them. If the case doesn't settle or the case goes haywire or for whatever reason, there is no funding available from a third party or uninsured or underinsured, is my client going to get a bill in the mail for what they just took out? Am I going to get a bill in the mail? Am I on the hook? Is my law firm on the hook? There's a bajillion questions that keep you up at night. And I think at one point in time, we were on the phone talking about this when I was having such apprehensiveness about it and being apprehensive. You said, Steve, breathe for a second and just listen. At the end of the day, if there's no money, you can't get blood from a stone. So talk to me a little bit about that in a sense of, all right, case goes through, this person borrowed all this money. It could be as little or as much as you can think. And now there's no settlement. The settlement just doesn't exist and it's never going to happen.
So as you mentioned, we have people in-house that are evaluators of risk. And with that evaluation comes an estimate of not only how much we think a case will settle for, but when. And so through those metrics, we're able to assure ourselves and our investors. Most of the money that funders get is not through just goodwill or donation. It's money from private equity, from private investors. So there's an interest rate that we pay on these advances that we give out to plaintiffs. That being said, we put it out there to the marketplace as a non-recourse advance. So if your case settles for $0, you drop that loss, a plaintiff drops their lawsuit, they would not owe this advance back. It's almost handled as an expense on the case when the case resolves.
So for
if the case resolves.
Layman people and me being me, an English major, if there's very simple to our side of the PI side of contingency fee, if there's no settlement, there's no fee. Or in your case, if there's no settlement, there's no obligation for return by the individual who obtained that lending.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. That is correct.
So in regards to being the villain, how do you guys, because I know many times, even internally and even in my own intrusive thoughts, you guys sometimes become the villain early on. How do you guys deal with that stereotype and kind of take it on the chin and keep plugging forward? Because for those listeners and attorneys out there that may or may not know, as a law firm, we're not able to give money out. There's ethics rules, and it's for good reason. Because if you think about it, a client comes on, and we hire the client, and they want to borrow money from us, and then the settlement happens. That's a conflict of interest that is clear as day. So legal funding is this whole other kind of niche that allows the attorney to take a step back and say, hey, we can't give you money. We're not able to cut you checks. We're not allowed to give you money. The only thing we can do is advocate for you and deliver a settlement if, like that triangle, there's funds available through the insurance. How do you guys deal with that kind of persona? And I know that you're not a villain, but dealing with that in this space when all you're trying to help people, but the reality of it is it's business.
Yep. Yep. So I think that, many personal injury cases are somewhat formulaic. And as a funder, we are not lawyers. We have lawyers that work at ThriveS, but we are not sitting in your shoes. We don't know nuance like venue or something that might be a conversation with an adjuster that, we're not privy to or something like that. So I think to embrace the villain, villain word that you shared there, I think we have to be prudent that our money's at risk. And as a business, we are investing in these cases. Not all investments work out. And that's on us. And under the terms of our agreement, this is a non-recourse pre-settlement advance. So when there's no stone to get blood from, it's simply a write-off. It's simply the opportunity for us to hopefully put other investments that do produce full and complete outcomes, put them at the forefront to mitigate some of the losses.
So if I'm an injured party or John or Jane Doe gets hurt and they're represented by an attorney, how do we even begin the metric of how much money is appropriate? Because I know off camera, we've had discussions in a sense of, hey, maybe this is too much money or maybe this isn't enough. And the objective is as you said, it's not a villain like where we're like, all right, keep feeding it. I think of that, the Shop of Little Horror where the big plant is like, feed me, Seymour, feed me. And that's not what you guys are, because you've even said to me many times, like, hey, Steve, maybe we should curtail it here, or maybe we should reduce it here. How are you getting to that point when an attorney or a client is like, I need more money, like, just please give me the money to facilitate, okay, risk versus reward. This amount is getting larger. They're going to keep hitting up the well. the wells run dry. What is kind of going on in your head to steer attorneys, but also steer clients towards a place of compromise?
That's a great question, Steve. I think that we try, as I mentioned it before, we try to not get in the way. And so when I say not get in the way, when the case resolves, we don't want to be a burden to the case, to the client. We want to basically get repaid what's owed, what we've outlaid to the client. So I think that speaking purely to my business, we try to fund around 10 to 15% of what we're valuing the case. So at the onset, that might be a number that's relatively large. We don't want the client to take that number, but we want to have the bandwidth to make quick and easy decisions, get the clients the help that they need, not burden you. So we can go up to a certain threshold of funding with very little interaction, very little impediment to getting the client the money that they need. But
in regards to just talking with counsel and that back and forth, are you notifying counsel? Obviously, I know the answers to these questions, but it's more so of just the communication needs to be open. And I think there's a lot of do's and don'ts that you've seen over the years. So talk to me a little bit about, all right, this is client A. This is a perfect client. And not everybody's perfect. Everybody has their stresses and they deal with it accordingly. But client A is the ideal because they're listening to me, B, C, D. This client B just is not a good person to get an advance, or they are, but they're going to need some extra TLC. Talk to me a little bit about the buckets that different clients fall in, because I'm sure there's clients that you don't hear from, and then there's clients you hear from every month, every week, every day.
I don't know what movie it was or where it was popularized, but I feel like plaintiffs get into an accident. Let's use the motor vehicle scenario, and it's not their fault. They're hit by someone who's maybe distracted or rear-ended or something happens. And I think people revert to, this is a $1 million case. And so I think managing expectations from a funder standpoint is certainly less critical than the attorney managing their expectations, but it's just as important. You know, we're dealing in real money. We're dealing in real money that's coming very early. And I think that being transparent to what we can do for them, but being the villain in the sense to say, hey, I've got this money. I know you need this money. I can do up to $10,000. Not giving them that information, but also managing it on more of a short-term basis. What do you need to help with necessities for the next 3 months? Let me fill that gap right now, because in 3 months, your needs might change. You might be feeling better. We might be closer to settling and resolving the case. Or that 3 months, nothing could change except your treatment, and we could be looking at doing another advance for the client.
Now, is this, and a lot of people are like, oh, this is a shady business or whatever it may be. Is this stuff that's all communicated and written to the client, or is they're taking out $500, $1,000, and then boom, at the end, they're getting hit with X amount that they owe? Is expectations being communicated, but is it also being saying like, hey, this is where it caps out at? Is there a cap out point? This is what you're looking at. This is the most you'll owe. So at least they're aware and there's no surprises at the end of the case.
So the process, if I could kind of go back for a minute, the process of getting funding to a client not only involves communication with the attorney and certainly communication with the plaintiff, but there is a contract involved. And that contract is between the attorney, between the funding company, and between the plaintiff. And it lays out a lot of information. Typical funding contracts could range from 10 to 20 pages. Who has time to read 10 or 20 pages around getting my client $500? So the meat of that contract for the plaintiff is the interest rate, which we don't call interest, we call it accrual, the accrual rate and what it looks like for having to be repaid, you know, down the road. And this could be down the road 3 months, this could be down the road 3 years. And so what funders do is they separate their agreements into three or six month buckets. These are accrual buckets, which means that because of the amount of interest that we're paying on the money, it gets broken out into a table. And basically that table has the interest and the accrual for 6 months out, 12 months out, 18 months, and et cetera. The reason we do that is because it's very easy to convey to a plaintiff that if your case doesn't settle for a year, this is the number you're going to be looking at.
And to piggyback off that, I think that that's also vital that a law firm and attorneys are also communicating with them, hey, your case isn't going to settle tomorrow. If there's no insurance or it's a minimum policy and you're catastrophically injured, 30 days, 60 days is probably the number. But the reality of it is many times, especially with these higher value cases, they're going a year, they're going 2 years, they're going 3 years. So for you to jump back into it, that bucket of, hey, 3 months, 6 months, and then this is the maximum amount that you're looking at, right, is kind of something that you could talk with them about.
Right. And not only that, but two, you know, many funders implement a cap, so the accrual will not surpass a certain amount. You know, that gives the client assurances that this $500 will not turn into, you know, $5,000. And it also gives the attorney the ability to say, I don't need to rush. You know, like, not that you would do that, but, you know, I have a process to follow, and I'm assured that this $500 will not exceed X. And I think that's important, again, not only for transparency, but to have on the contract so that they can see, you know, what it looks like, you know, because I think most consumers, and I can speak for myself, I'm not looking at all the fine print of a 10 to 20 sure. page contract. I'm not knowledgeable enough around what it states. I want to know, how much money am I taking now? How much will I owe back, and when will I owe it back by?
Now, as a backup to that contract, can anybody just be legal funding? Can it be just John Smo and Jane Doe legal funding for personal injury cases? Or is there a vetting process? I know a lot of people say, oh, the business bureau or licensing, or there needs to be some sort of filing with the state or Commonwealth. Talk to me a little bit about how you get to the place that you are, because there's a lot of pretenders out there, the dabblers, rather than a reputable place like Thrivus, for instance.
Currently, the landscape of lending is that you, as long as you have money and have a contract to support the funding that you're doing, or a relationship with an attorney, there is very low threshold to enter the space.
Okay.
Some states have licensure requirements where funders have to post bond, where you have different checklist of items that you have to adhere to. Your contract has to look a certain way. Some states consider what we do not in advance, but a loan. So it follows some consumer protections. But you don't want to get into the funding space if you're expecting a quick return. Many people, you know, gamblers, you know, want to lay a bet and get paid on that bet. That's not litigate, or that's not pre-settlement funding.
So what's some red flags in regards to, if I'm looking not just at Thrivus with scrutiny, but under a magnifying glass, but other individuals as well in funding, what is something from a PI space? We always say that a person or a practitioner that's doing criminal law, personal injury, notarization, family law, all those things under one roof kind of warrants the red flag, in a sense of they're not going to, not saying that not all do, but it's a red flag, at least if I'm looking from a PI standpoint in, to say you're doing many fields here. Right? You can't be a master. And that's kind of problematic. Is there something that sticks to your head that, all right, this is something that if you see this, you need to run the other way, or you need to at least kind of get out of that situation?
Yep. I would advise their clients, if they're looking for an advancement, to talk to their attorney. I do not advise plaintiffs to go on the internet and try to search litigation loan, because that's where you find some of the underbelly of the players in the industry that I don't want to say are a bit unsavory, but we have two classifications of funders in our space. The one is a funder, like Thrivus Link. The other would be a broker. So not too unlike your auto insurance, you can go and find someone that'll find you the best funding opportunity for you. They don't do that for free. They charge the client, the plaintiff, for that service, and it can sometimes be in a percentage, maybe 10 to 20% of what they're funding a client. So let's say, for an example, client is out looking for funding. It's 2 a.m. They're looking on the internet and they find, you know, XYZ funder. They look like a funder. They smell like a funder. You apply with them. Then all of a sudden they contact your attorney and get some information and let them know that they connected with them. Then you get the funding contract, and for $1,000, you're paying $200 or $300 as a processing fee or an origination fee. That's the broker's fee. And so I think plaintiffs need to be careful when they're entertaining this as an option, to trust your attorney. Trust that you can talk to your attorney and say, hey, Steve, I'm in a spot. I can't earn. I can't walk. I need help. and let the attorney navigate that path. I think any good attorney will be willing to have that conversation early on to hopefully avoid some of the pitfalls.
It kind of reminds me of like a mortgage company when you're going to close on a house. The two kind of analogy that you gave me, going through that process, you have people throwing all these numbers at you, and they can kind of juice up some numbers if they want to, hide things here, hide things there. Kind of seems like that's what you're saying in the comparison of the space of a broker and the finder's fee. Hey, that number looks sexy, or that interest rate looks sexy, but it's getting pushed up by all these hidden fees that otherwise wouldn't be there if you went through a source like Thrivus.
Right.
So a jumping point of talking about those red flags that we were just kind of touching base on and bringing to light. There's a lot of, if I'm taking money, I want to know, and you touched on it briefly earlier, but I want to flesh it out a little bit more, of those red flags, but also the cap. So, and I know that this is a state by state. We practice in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth. So you can kind of highlight those if you wish, but I know that this is not going to be a collection and a blanket explanation. I'm taking out $500, and then I want to know, what is the most money that I'm going to owe on that? Whereas if it's a broker or somebody else, there's 100, 150% APR. Those interests is much more higher than that. So talk to me a little bit about, this might be another red flag that you may see in your practice with legal funding.
So simply put, I think it's the duty of the plaintiff and the attorney to some degree to ask a funder what they're charging. Get in bed with a situation or a funder where you're paying exorbitant fees or accruing at 100, 150% APR. Being that we're in somewhat of the Wild West with regards to our industry, where some states have chosen a complete hands-off approach to mitigating what funders charge, or unregulating, I should say, what funders charge, then I think a big red flag would be when you see that accrual table, if $500 has a chance of approaching $5,000 owed back, big red flag. I think that a funder tries to protect itself against crazy accretion, but also a return. You know, that $500 to the funder is not free. That accrues significant interest to the point where when the case does resolve, if there is a cap in place, let's say the cap's at 2.5x. So a $500 advance would cap out somewhere around $1,500. That might not be a number that it's even going to reach in 2.5 years, when that cap would trigger, or 3 years. You know, so I think just speaking specifically to caps, sometimes they're appropriate, sometimes they're imperative, sometimes they just frankly don't matter.
So you made a good point. So when a client's looking at the contract or looking for funding, in especially the PI space, they want to know worst case scenario. So if they're looking at it and they're saying, all right, I'm going to take 500 out, the most that I can owe on this in a typical space is 1500. At least I know the best day, worst day. And like you mentioned, I think you had a good point. If your attorney's doing their job adequately, and there are obviously exceptions to every situation, the 500 isn't ever going to get that 1500. And that's something that, in regards to, if I'm looking at a larger number and I come to you as an attorney, and again, this is a case by case, how often are lenders losing money, and how often are you willing to reduce the balance of what is contractually owed? I know, and I'm putting you on the spot, we had a case that an individual settled, and I saw the timeline that the interest was going to accrue after the certain amount of time. And that was $200 or $300. It seems minimal, but in this space and in these clients, every penny counts. And ultimately, what the holdup was the insurance company cutting us the check and us depositing it. And I contacted you and I said, hey, are you willing to freeze it here, because we're going to have the check cut, and it's going to be just one day over. And not to steal your thunder, but your response was, yeah, that's fine. That's it's not like you're not going to get me the money. It's just going to be a day late. Talk to me a little bit about how you guys kind of navigate that, where the attorney is saying, hey, this is the situation. This is me being transparent. This is me communicating. I don't want the client to bear the ultimate cost of the delay.
So I think that any funder, I think I can comfortably speak for everyone in our space, does not want to lose the principal. They don't want to create a situation where, again, we're a burden to the resolution of the case. You've asked a couple times, you know, how often do we lose? How often do we reduce? And it's a very fluid conversation, you know, with the attorney to tell us, you know, high level, you know, what is the situation? We don't know what that day, that judge, that mediator is saying, that adjuster, what are they coming to the table with? So sometimes we need to make these situations and decisions quickly, because you don't have hours or days to go into the, you know, minutia of every dollar here, every dollar there. So I think that the reduction piece of it is a fair part of our business. When a case comes down to the finish, I call it the red zone, you know, so we're in the red zone, we're getting ready to resolve this matter. Settlement is on the horizon. We are there. For us to dig in and say that we are owed X and we are not accepting less than X, I think is somewhat short-sighted to the relationship with the plaintiff, the relationship with the attorney. So I don't think that we're in the business to lose. Sometimes we do lose, but we're in the business to bring to resolution the case and to not be a burden, to not get in the way, to not make a case unsettleable because you're going into an event knowing that Thrivest has a lien that's X and it's non-negotiable.
So it's, and that just reminded me of one thing. It's, we've been talking a lot about the client space and we've dabbled in some of the PI and how it's applicable. One thing that I don't think many attorneys think of is the information that we share with you can be subpoenaed. And I'm sure defense counsel out there is listening to this and they're going to start subpoenaing any and all records of cases. But how do you kind of see that shake out? I mean, in my head, I can kind of see how it shakes out in a court. Is it ultimately admissible? No. But how have you seen it enter the space? Because I know that we've had some experiences where if it's a larger number, that's something that the client is concerned about. They're concerned about their settlement, but they're also concerned about this lien out here too. And sometimes it benefits the PI side, the plaintiff side, in a sense of saying, we have this lien for funding. Our client didn't want to get here. They didn't want to do this. But this may enter the fray of negotiation where you might be thinking of XYZ settlement, but we want to bump it up to the ABC because of this. So talk to me a little bit about how many times have you seen it subpoenaed? What would you kind of talk about in a sense of don't say this if you're talking with us, because it can be problematic. And then how you kind of see the liens enter the negotiation fray of what's owed.
I'm glad you brought that up, Steve. I, as a public service announcement, never share with a funder anything that, certainly anything that's privileged, anything that you wouldn't want opposing counsel to see, expert reports I'm thinking of, or something that is proprietary to the case that might help the funder evaluate the risk or the exposure, but could certainly get in the wrong hands, could possibly have adverse effects. So that's my first statement. And any funder that asks you for that kind of thing, maybe have a conversation with them, maybe not a funder you necessarily want to trust or work with. But that being said, let's say we're after that fact. You know, if we get served a subpoena, we have to adhere to the subpoena. So that would be any work product that we have that we've used to evaluate the case. I don't know many funders that keep track of phone calls and anything that's not in print, but if we are subpoenaed for that, we would turn that over. That being said, it doesn't happen very often, nor do I have attorneys typically send me anything that is going to put us in a precarious position.
So it's 2025. We're going to get in 2026 soon. The PI field and PI industry has shifted towards AI. It's shifted towards outside brokerage firms and big money, Wall Street money coming in and kind of swooping things away. Where do you see the future of injury funding going? Is it going to be something that kind of like Bitcoin, you can go to a machine and type in the keypad, hey, I need this, and here's my social security number. Do you see it going to ChatGPT, Gemini, all those? Where do you kind of see the space evolving to in the next 5 to 10 years?
So I see... it's a very fluid space. I think that we serve an immense cause to help clients and to stand by the attorneys when they have clients in need. That being said, I think that there are lawmakers, there is legislation, there are always pitfalls, not too unlike your industry, that we have to be aware of. But I think we play in a space that we feel like we're helping. When there are changes, we roll with the punches. Right now, majority of decisions are at the state level. So there might be a state we can fund in one day that legislation passes that we can't fund in the next day.
Would that be a good example? That'd be kind of like sports betting, where it's a state-by-state entity. I think of FanDuel, I think of DraftKings, where each state kind of has their own rules and regulations. But do you see a world where it kind of becomes too big for its own good, or do you see people evolving, or these small kind of entities? Because, I mean, personally, Credisco and Sale is a smaller law firm, but we service a lot of areas because we are quality over quantity. You see those big funders out there, and you see those big law businesses that are sometimes quantity over quality. Do you see Thrivus maintaining that status quo in a sense of being that mom and pop kind of shop mantra in the TLC, or do you guys see yourself going to trying helping more people and growing?
So I think we're always trying to grow and become a larger servicer of our space. I think that comes with a lot of challenges that has us appreciate the ma and pop style of what we do. But don't let me get it wrong. You know, Thrivus is a tier one funder. You know, we are as big as many in the space. If you're just looking at quantity, that's not always good. That's not always bad. I think that's just the minute you stop touching your clients and stop being honest and transparent, you know, that's where problems happen. And we've been very absent of that.
You say tier one. What does that mean by tier one? And as a segue as well, talk to me a little bit about Thrivus's reputation, and this is kind of your spot here to talk to me a little about how Thrivus complaints. Because when I go, and it's funny you mentioned it, when you go on Google and you type in at 2 a.m. Legal funding, you get a lot of entities, and you get a lot of entities with like 2 stars, 4 stars, 3.5 stars, complaints, lawsuits, and everything else. So where does Thrivus kind of rank amongst that?
So I use tier one in a sense of just adding validity to the amount of capital we're able to deploy. And I think that we are not a broker. We are a funder. We belong to an organization called ALFA, which is the American Legal Finance Association, which is a collective of funders that make sure that a big pitfall in what we do is double funding. You know, you want to make sure that if a plaintiff takes funding from one of those companies that A, doesn't belong to Alpha, but B, they're finding on the internet, that we're aware of their lien. What we don't want are, you know, clients that have multiple fundings, pre-settlement advances in my space from multiple companies. So organizations like Alpha add some credibility to what we do. They post best practices. You know, they make sure that clients are aware. And if you belong to Alpha, that means something. If you belong to these trading organizations, it gives you validity in a sense that you're not fly by night. You know, you're well capitalized and have the ability to help quantity, but a responsible quantity.
So if you're a PI attorney or an injured party, how do we get in touch with Thrivus, or how do we get in touch with you? What would be the best practice per se in order to facilitate a communication between your attorney to Thrivus, or communication from an injured party to you?
So if I were a plaintiff, I would do my homework. I would make sure that I went on websites. I looked at their Google reviews. Now, obviously, who leaves reviews? It's the people that absolutely love you and the people that absolutely hate you. So take that with a titch bit of grain of salt. But we're at thrivuslink.com. That's Thrivest link.com. Check us out and make your own decisions. You know, like I'm saying Thrivus is the best because I work there and I know the people, and I've humanized the interactions with people that we've helped. I've had clients cry, you know, how much we've helped them, even despite the interest or the accrual that they pay. So just do your homework and check us out. Check all the companies out. Look at their website. If they can't, I'll end with this, you know, just from this standpoint. If you call a funder and ask them what they charge for an advance and they can't give you that answer, hang up the phone. Call another funder. They should be able to provide that information, and you'd be shocked how many times there's answers that are given that are inconclusive, where they can't just tell you, hey, if I took $500, what would I owe? You know.
And if you have any other questions that we didn't, or topics that we didn't touch on today, you can drop a comment and we'll get that answer to you, or direct it to someone who can reach out and talk with you. And if there's anything that we didn't answer or touch on today, you can drop us a comment. Also, in addition to the ThriveIsLink.com, there's also FundingWithAndy.com that you can check out and ask questions and get some of the answers to some questions you may have that we didn't touch on. This has been another great episode of the Injury Pros Podcast. Give us a like, give us a listen on all of your social media and streaming services, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube. You can see me in the flesh and my hairline coming back with vengeance. It's been a great time. Stay well, stay safe.